You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And. We welcome Laura Huang back to the podcast. She is a distinguished professor of management and organizational development at Northeastern University and has held faculty positions at Harvard Business School and the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. And we were just realizing that we actually met 10 years ago when Laura interviewed me and my co-author Tom Yorton about our book, Yes And. And then we had her on the pod 5 years ago to talk about her book, Edge. And now she's back to talk about her new book. This is a really intriguing topic. The book is called, you already know, The Science of Mastering Your Intuition. So enjoy the pod.
Unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Laura Huang, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you, Kelly. It's always a pleasure. So, you know, we go back now more than a decade. So
we do. We go back decade. Look at us. So in 2008, you actually began work on your PhD dissertation, which was about gut feel in the world of investment decisions.
Yes.
And you note in the book that dozens of esteemed scholars told you not to study this topic. Why?
Yeah. You know, it was funny because, the term gut feel, just even starting there, the term gut feel is so loaded in the sense that we all think we know what gut feel is, but then when we actually dig a little bit deeper, we all have very, very different definitions of what it is, right? So everything from some people think of it like a mystical kind of superpower. Other people are like, no, it can't be trusted, right? It's something that you need data to back up and to really trust, right? So there were all of these sort of lay definitions of what gut feel was. And so when I said, you know what, I want to study gut feel, I want to put some science behind it, people were like, oh, wow, that's like super risky. It's this like term that's not theoretical. It's atheoretical. Yeah. You're never going to get a job. It's not like you're studying something that's like rigorous and academic. It's something that's seen as like this, everyday kind of thing that people talk about. So that was where I just got tons of resistance around this topic in general. But the more I got the resistance, the more I was sort of, well, on the one hand, I was like, oh man, should I, like, kind of second guessing myself, but then my own gut feel kicked in, right? And I come from an engineering background where I had tried to quantify everything. And so it seemed like a fun challenge for me to try and quantify the unquantifiable, something that everyone was saying was unquantifiable, and actually putting a science behind understanding our intuition and our gut feel.
All right. So the first thing you do is distinguish between gut feel and intuition. How are those two things different?
Yeah. So that's, starting from, what I just talked about, right? Even these two words, gut feel and intuition, we tend to use them interchangeably.
Yeah.
And that's part of the problem. So what I found was that, actually intuition and gut feel can be thought of as two very separate entities, right? When we have a gut feel, it is this moment where we have this moment of sort of understanding, but there's a process that leads up to that, right? So there is what is called an intuiting process. And at some point along this process, we have a gut feel outcome. And our gut feel outcome is really the result of everything that's happening during this process, where we are taking our personal experiences and our expertise and all the things, our culture, our background, even our trauma, but also data, right? The data that we're seeing. So data is also a piece of this. And we're combining this data and our personal experiences and our background and our culture and all these things. And it culminates in this outcome, which is our gut feel. And what the reason why it sometimes gets tricky is that this long intuiting process is not always long, right? Sometimes that process can be a couple of seconds. Sometimes it's decades. But there's always some sort of a process that culminates in this summary, this like executive summary gut feel. And that's what that outcome is.
Okay, so we should probably introduce priors and prompts to this. Or what, I don't know if it's a 2x2 or what it is in terms of, because my brain doesn't think that way. but it's really important, which is, because you sort of alluded to it already. So we have this intuitive process, which is, and this stuff isn't linear. So, you know that as well. But gut comes in a decision-making process when you decide to sort of act on it. Talk to us about priors and prompts, because data figures in there.
So absolutely, right? So this is where, this is where sometimes, right, even though this is the science behind it and I'm trying to quantify the unquantifiable, you know, because we're trying to think about it in terms of like really disentangling what it is and putting the science behind it, it's not always parsimonious, right? It's not always super easy to encapsulate what this is. And that's what makes it hard. That's why we sometimes are like, no, it's easier just to think of this. Think of gut feel as this like superpower, mystical kind of thing that suddenly appears and is subconscious, right? It's not linear, right? Like, as you said, it's not there. We have to explain it linearly, but and in terms of like writing a book, you have to read it linearly. But the actual process and understanding all of this is not linear at all, right? And so what I sort of started out doing was first understanding, okay, well, we have to kind of move backwards, right? When we have that feeling of gut feel, it portrays itself or it manifests itself to all of us in different ways, right? It's very unique to each of us. And the priors and prompts that you bring up is one of the ways that I try to study this and run, studies and experiments and like gather data to kind of understand how does it manifest itself. So I'll step back a little bit and I'll talk about the priors and prompts piece, right? So what I found is that our gut feel really appears to all of us in one of three ways, right? And so the three waves, these general kind of buckets, right? The first is as a eureka moment, right? So we have this like, ah, yes, you know, that typical kind of eureka moment. The second is a spidey sense, like, oh, like something doesn't feel right. Like, I don't know what this is, but something's like, I have this gut feel that something's not right. That's spidey sense. And the third is a jolt, right? It's this moment of recognition where we realize that something has changed. Something has shifted. Like what we thought we knew before, what we thought we had always understood is now really, really different. Okay. So there's these three sort of categories, the eureka moments, the spidey senses, and the jolts. Now we feel these differently, right? So my eureka moment might manifest itself very different than your eureka moment. Right? My eureka moment might feel like uncomfortable, or it might be like, I might get a moment of excitement, right? Yours, you might feel physically, for example, in the gut of your, right, in your like lower, you know, stomach, I don't know. So we feel it differently. We feel it differently. We have different signals, right? Physically, emotionally, cognitively, right? And so on and so forth. So, but these are the sort of general kind of groupings. Now, the priors and the prompts, that's how we actually start to realize, right? Eureka moments is where there's a match between our priors and prompts. Spidey sense is where there's actually a mismatch between the priors and prompts. And jolts are where we're seeing a complete shift in our priors. So let me explain a little bit about what priors and prompts even are so that we can see when there's a match and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. So priors are all of the things that we know, all of the things, and it comes from Bayesian statistics, right? These priors and these prompts. So priors are just things we know from our experiences, our expertise, the people we've encountered, the times when we've been backstabbed, right? Everything, right? These are all of our priors. And a prompt is something that comes up at that moment that takes us to sort of a level of awareness, right? So it might be like, you know, someone says something and it cues something for us. Or it might be that we read something, we're reading the newspaper and there's one phrase. It might be that, you know, it could be something much larger, right? Like we see that we were in some sort of an accident, or, you know, there's these things that happen that are the prompts. And when there's sort of this match between the priors and the prompts, we might realize something new. Okay, so let me give you a couple of examples to sort of illustrate this a little more. Let me start with the jolt, right? Because that one's maybe a little bit more abstruse and harder to sort of capture. So one of the people that I spoke with and I talk about in my book is a man named Dan Gusty, and he's a really interesting person because he is a world famous chef. He was a chef that was at the three Michelin star restaurant Noma in Copenhagen, which was voted the world's best restaurant in the world numerous times, and they have three Michelin stars. And he was the head chef at Noma. His career was going fabulously, all sorts of things. And at one point, he was reading a magazine article, and they spoke about something in the article about, you know, food for all, right? Something around that sort of concept. And he had this, like, jolt moment, right? So the prompt was reading this article. The priors was everything leading up to this moment where he was reading this article, where he had, you know, accumulated all this experience. He was at the top of his game. He was head chef at one of the most revered, well-known restaurants in the world. But when those two things matched together, he had this jolt. And he talks about how everything he thought he knew before, he felt like this fundamental shift. And it was like he was playing a video game. And he was brought from, like, you know, mushroom world to, like, the next level of consciousness. And now he was in, like, dragons and laser beam world, right? And he realized, oh my gosh, like, I want to be, you know, so he used his skills, and now he basically left Noma, and he started Brigade, which is he provides restaurant services and food for everyone, right? Cafeterias, food for children in cafeterias, food in prisons for incarcerated individuals, food for individuals in nursing homes, right? And this is a, you know, three-star Michelin chef who's now trying to provide accessible food for everyone, right? And when you talk to him more, you learn all sorts of things about him, right? And all the things that are buried in his priors around how he used to make sauce with his grandmother, right? Make tomato sauce with his grandmother, and how she used to talk about how they would allow, you know, neighbors, everyone, food for all, like people coming into their house to share in this communal meal, right? All these things that were sort of buried in there. So that's kind of one example of, like, trying to explain how did these prompts and priors come together and match up to give us that trigger point or catalyze that gut feel that we're having.
It's hard not for me, of course, not to immediately tie this into improvisation. So go with me just a little bit on this.
Yeah, and I know, it's so related. So I love where you're going to take us here.
Okay. So I think about early stage improvisers and what we're trying to get them to embody and think. And they're both are important. Because so much of it is physically putting yourself in the space, get you out of your fear brain, your shame brain, get you out of your judgment brain, judgment of self, judgment of others. And one of the key points is also, like, you are enough. What we're trying to tell you is that everything you have is enough to do this job. We're going to present a series of exercises that are going to allow you to have a very specific point of focus to understand that if you just accomplish this game, that's all you need to do. You're building the skills that are going to take you on this journey. And the journey then becomes this ability to enter any scene with zero script in your mind. Because if you come in pre-scripted, the other person doesn't have the same script because there isn't a script. So if you come in pre-scripted, you're already at a disadvantage. Mm-hmm. However, the way you do that successfully is recognizing you have all the scripts in the world behind you, and you can incorporate all of them, whether they are characters and ideas or a funny thing someone said on the bus or whatever, if it becomes appropriate at this time. And it's really sort of this quick switch between system one and system two, Danny Kahneman's work, that goes back and forth where, like you are relying on instinct. You are getting prompts. I mean, sometimes the audience gives you a prompt. Sometimes your player across from you gives you a prompt. The environment can give you a prompt when something happens in the room. A gift to a gifted improviser is like someone's phone goes off in the room and right. They incorporate that. That's they close the window. Yeah, it's a great prompt. But it can elicit all kinds of things. But it does require a kind of almost Buddhist emptiness. You can't be attached to the idea that you maybe wandered in with because you're building this thing together. I'm going to stop there.
Yeah, no, I think that so much of what you're saying, I mean, I've got like, three or four different thoughts based on what you're saying, because absolutely, right? When you, when you're engaging in improv, there's absolutely the priors, which is all that you know. It's like who mm-hmm. you are. It's the experiences you have that you bring into improv. You definitely have the prompt, whether it's one that's staged and you're giving one. But this sort of pre-screening, if you're bringing in things from other people, it takes away from you being in yeah. that experience and engaging in that. Right. And so what I talk about is like, well, we already talked a little bit about like the what is gut feel piece, the question of like what is gut feel. But this is why one of the key principles of what I studied around gut feel is that we're asking the wrong question. And that's related to what you're saying. It's not what is gut feel. It's who is gut feel, right? Who is gut feel? And the gut feel is you, right? Your gut feel is going to be very different from my gut feel, even if we're in the same exact situation. Right? We can have all of the same context. We can have all of the same parameters. We can have all of the same, things that we're interacting with. But you will have a very different gut feel than I will because you bring with yourself, right, different background, different experiences, different expertise, different learnings, all sorts of things. And it's the same with improv, right? If you were improvising a scene where a cell phone went off and I was improvising a scene where a cell phone went off, we should, in fact, improvise in very, very different ways. And that's what's going to make it successful. Because if I tried to do it in your way or you tried to do it in my way, it really would be, it wouldn't come off in the same way, right? So I think that's something that's really important to sort of recognize is this who is the person that is approaching this. I'll sort of stop there as well because I have tons of sort of things that you could talk about in terms of how this overlaps.
So the demand I see here on individuals is self-knowledge. So with that, which may seem obvious, but is rarely the case in a lot of these situations, which is I'm going to give you an example of a thing I thought of as we've been talking, which is, I've been very conscious. So I'm an idea person. I am what I think is often referred to as an intrapreneur. Mm-hmm. I do entrepreneurial stuff inside a framework at Second City. I've always done this my whole career. I have a tendency to yes and a lot, which is good if I want to sell books, but sometimes means I've got just way too big of a list of things I've maybe said yes to. So very conscious right now of like what's on my plate, what can I take on, what can I not take on, and in the past, knowing that I'm just like, I'm the guy like, yeah, Kelly, get it done. So I got an email from a guy. He's like, I don't know if you remember me. We worked on a project that didn't go anywhere like 10 years ago. I'm working on this film. Interested maybe casting Second City people. So my spidey sense went off, which was this person wants to pay us nothing to take advantage of a, skill we've got in identifying people. And so my response was, hey, I just need some clarity. Are you looking to hire Second City to do casting services? And I was very proud of myself because I sent this email and then sent one back. It's like, you know, perhaps we should have a finished script in a little bit. I want to have a conversation. So I just added in our director of development for the conversation. So I said, great, we can have a conversation. And the good thing about this from my perspective is I created a boundary. I created a sort of an expectation both for myself and for this person that nothing's for free. But I didn't close the door because I hate closing. It is impossible for me to close a door. I've never understood that. There's, you know, who knows what's standing behind this door. However, I can't keep the door open. So it's like, and I'm combining like past experience, intuition, yeah. My gut feel in this, what's maybe seemingly a minor thing, but it's not in terms of like, what are we, but the tasks we do every day.
Yeah.
And this thing could have thrown me off for like a week.
Yeah. You know, so I think what you're sort of recognizing. Okay. So then first of all, like even just from the very simple piece of like, you can't burn bridges, you can't close doors, yeah. Right? Sometimes we need to like burn bridges. We need, I mean, we all come from this standpoint where we're trying to get people to agree with us and we're getting people to see our point of view and we're trying to get, but sometimes we need to burn those bridges because if we don't burn those bridges, then we're never able to walk across the other bridges that are far afield because we're always sort of looking backwards, right? So, you know, I think that's one thing that you, when you're saying that, I thought of that, right? We want to close some doors, not all of them, right? We don't want to be carelessly closing doors and burning bridges. Mm-hmm. But, you know, sometimes you just know, right? You know, and you just don't want to admit it to yourself. And that's part of, you know, what the gut feel. Like, you know, you already know that there are some things, there are certain people, there are certain habits, there are certain tendencies, there are certain just things in our lives that we need to be able to rid ourselves of. You know, there's always this advice like, you know, hire slow, fire fast. And I don't mean that like, you know, it's not so rigid. Like, I don't mean to, I don't want people in corporations to be like, what, fire fast? What about all these? But, you know, you get my point, right? We should be.
No, you know, we delay that all the time. And we always know.
Bringing things, new things into your life slowly, being very methodical and careful, but get rid of yourself of things very, very quickly. So anyways, that's my first point that I was going to say to that. The second is like, when you were speaking a little bit about, you know, the sort of prompts for yourself and how, like, even back when you were talking about, you know, the cell phone going off.
Yeah.
That, like, the cell phone going off and that's this gift. Yeah. What happens in our lives sometimes is we need to build in moments where we give ourselves those gifts. We don't always notice the prompts, even when the universe is trying to tell us, or, you know, we need to somehow be able to build those into our lives. And this leads to sort of two key things, right? The first is like this notion that we often don't listen to what whispers. We listen to what screams, right? And so when you were talking about your story around the email that you got, right? Something was already whispering to you. You already knew the answer, right? You tried to play coy a little bit, write back the email, we would love to talk when you're ready to hire somebody, CCing people, but you already knew the answer, right? Come on, Kelly, you knew.
Totally knew the answer.
Right? And so we sometimes don't always listen to what whispers because we're in this society, we're in this realm where there's so many things that are screaming at us. Right. And so we don't listen to what whispers, we listen to what screams. And it's not always our fault. Right. There are things that are screaming at us all the time. Right. There's physically, you know, like vacuum machines and ambulances and things that are loud. But there's also just, you know, we're getting recommended the next YouTube video to watch before we even get to make the decision. Right. So or we're getting the next Netflix suggestion or and then in the instance of like, what you were talking about, we start CCing people, right? We start adding people because we're like, oh, well, that'll kind of help. Like bringing more people into the mix will sort of help with this. But in fact, right, that's like when we're making a big decision in our lives, what do we usually do? We do that. We go to people that we know and we're like, what would you do? Right here, let me explain the situation. What do you think? Da, da, da. What are, right? And it's like the equivalent of having a dinner party and we've got this big decision to make. And so we invite lots of people, people that we do love and trust, and we give each of them a seat at the dinner table. We talk about this thing. But what we don't do is the equivalent of saving one of those seats for ourselves, and our voice and what's whispering. Because even though we love and trust all of these people, they are different. They're different people that come from different, they've had different experiences. They've worked in different industries. So we want to be able to listen to what whispers and not what screams. And so one of the ways we can do that is, number one, being attuned to those prompts, right? How do we sort of amplify that signal so we start to notice those catalyzing prompts that might be leading us to a gut feel? And so that's one of the ways that I talk about in the book, because we can harness that. We can hone that. We can actually train ourselves to, we can train our gut feel so that we can make those decisions and trust in those decisions. But even before that, even before we've gotten to the point where we can train that, there are tips and tools and tactics that we can start to put into place that will help us along the way. And one of those that I talk about is like this story of one of my former students who was in the special forces, this very elite military division, where he had to decide which cadets to bring with him into, as part of the infantry. And so I tell this story about how, like, you know, people are training all the time for this. This is a very, prestigious sort of thing. And there was one guy who just worked tremendously hard, right? He worked so hard. He wanted to, he deserved it, right? In all, every sense of the word. But this student of mine who was the head of this brigade, like, had this feeling like, I don't know why, but I'm so hesitant about putting him in, right? Like bringing him in into the fold. And so his superior said, flip a coin, right? If it's heads, he's in it. If it's tails, it's not. And he's like, what? Flip a coin? Like, that's how you're going to make a decision about this? Right? So he flipped this coin, and what he realized was that was like the prompt. It was like a self-enforced prompt where he realized that, like, heads tells me I should put him in. But it made him realize, I wish that it had been tails. Even though it was heads, I wish it had been tails, because I don't trust him when we're in battle. Right? Even though he did all of the things that he needed to do, he worked tremendously hard checking off all of the boxes, there was something around, like, now I'm putting him in charge of other people's lives. Now I'm actually, this was a guy he really liked, he really respected, but there was a scarcity to it where he can only put one person in that position, and he had to put someone where he was going to entrust other people's lives, including his own, with this person. And so when he said, I wished it was tails, right, that's what sort of prompted and allowed him to see that gut feel.
So that's totally a thing that pops up in casting at Second City. And I look back, and every casting mistake that I made was when I gave it to someone who deserved it rather than was right for the role.
Right. Yeah. And it's sort of unfortunate, because, like, it kind of speaks to, like, what I wrote about in my first book, right? Which was, around edge and how do you gain an edge? Because, the reality of it is, we think about this world as a very meritocratic world, but we know that there's this myth of meritocracy, right?
Yes,
you can take two people who work equally as hard, and one of them will inevitably be more successful than the other, right? And why is that? Well, it's because there are these perceptions and these signals and these cues. And so my first book was all about, like, actually flip those obstacles in our favor. How do we flip the adversity, the constraints, even the stereotypes to work in our favor? Right. And so it's just about having much more authentic, deeper, richer interpersonal connections with people, because, there is the case sometimes where, we need to rely, and, your example, we do need to rely on our, our intuition and our gut feel in many instances, because we will never have all of the data. Data is 100% a part of our gut feel, but data will only ever encompass 80% of what we need to know in making that decision. And so we need to be able to hone and train our own mental models and schemas and prototypes and patterns so that we can actually be making those decisions in a way that we can trust and rely upon.
I want to talk to you about chapter 8. And this is where you talk about sort of the embodied nature of this. So one of the things that I always talk about, and I think is important with regard to improvisation, is it's rich in movement, that there's, it's embodied learning, meaning you sort of feel what it's like to do the thing, which we think is very important in order to then successfully or wisely do the thing you need to do to be successful. And I've gotten into this argument with people like Scott Barry Kaufman, my dear friend.
Yes!
I know you're Scotty. About, you know, the body and the mind and where it's connected to where it's not. But for myself, increasingly as I age and with experiences, my body is speaking to me often before my brain is.
Yeah.
That's a thing?
So, yeah, it absolutely is a thing, right? When I spoke earlier about, you know, our gut feel manifests in multiple ways, right? We have a physical reaction, we have an emotional reaction, we have a cognitive, we have all these different reactions. And I'll talk a little bit about, you know, we'll start with this sort of embodied piece, but I also want to talk later a little bit about the emotional piece, because sometimes people are like, the question comes up often, well, isn't gut feel just our emotions, right? Isn't it just like a feeling of excitement or anxiety or something? So we'll get there in a second, but the physical, the embodied piece is so critical, because this is one of those things that sometimes people are like, oh yeah, whatever, like, okay, like we physically, you know, this, the, like, oh, it's about the gut, right? Like, oh, the gut feel, like you feel it in your sort of thing. Are we now getting to like this new age kind of thing where we need to take probiotics and all that? No, it's not quite. You know, there's an element of that, but it actually is much more scientific, right? And it also, not just scientific from like the standpoint of like biology, but there's also like a socio-biology to this, right? So let me explain. So yes, biologically, absolutely, there's a connection between the brain and the body, right? We know this, right? There's the vasovagal nerve, which goes all the way from, you know, our abdomen all the way to our brain, and then there's synapses and nodes and everything that are traveling all along the way. So, right, biologically, absolutely, there's a connection. However, when we think about it from a sociobiology perspective, what I found is that there are ways that we can also identify our gut feel, and not in this sort of like voodoo kind of way, right? So I have a good friend who is a brilliant psychologist. Her name is Erin Early. And what she does with her patients and with her clients and with anyone she sort of, you know, is interacting with, she has this thing where she realizes that sometimes, for example, that, you know, we don't always know what to trust, okay? We don't always know what to trust because, say, for example, you're someone who's been gaslighted your entire life, right? And so the things that you think you know are really different from what you actually know versus what you thought you knew and what you should know and so on and so forth, right? And so this sort of connects to what you're saying, but it's a little bit of a longer explanation, so work with me here for a second.
Yeah,
so,
go for it.
So basically, what she says, we have to sort of baseline. So she baselines by saying, like, okay, what is your name? And you would say, Kelly Leonard. And she'd say, okay, where did you feel that? And you're like, what? Where did I feel that? Like, I didn't really feel like, you know. And so she goes through this series of facts, things that you actually do know about yourself, right? You know, so-and-so's name is Mary. Mary, how many kids do you have? I have 2 children. What city do you live in? I live in this city. Things that are absolutely true and that you know at the core to be true. And she starts to sort of baseline, where do you feel that? Right. And then as she sort of progresses and she sort of does this cute thing where she's like, okay, now say my name is PP Penelope. Right. And then like, and then they're like, what? That's so silly. But then they say that. And she's like, where did you feel it? Now that's a lie. Right. And so we start to go, what she does, you start to go through and she baselines. And over time, what you realize is that your mind might lie to you in certain ways, but your body doesn't. And there's certain places where you start to feel it. Right. You might feel it. in the crook of your neck, right? You might feel it in your shoulders. Some people might feel it in the pit of their stomach, but there are certain places that you do kind of feel things. And I think that's really important to sort of make that connection so that when you have a spidey sense, certain people might feel it a certain way. When you have a eureka moment, it might be this burst of adrenaline and you feel it, your head feels kind of airy for a second. And recognizing those physical signals to yourself, in addition to the emotional signals, in addition to the cognitive signals, in addition to all the other things, you add this together and that's sort of that culminating factor.
Do you have any idea, is that something that builds upon itself from childhood? Is that something that might just change with regard to how you exist inside your body at any given time? I used to be athletic and I wasn't for a long time, and now I have a trainer I work with, and so I'm picking up on different things on my body simply because I'm paying attention and I didn't before. It strikes me that it's not necessarily static.
Yeah, it's not static, but you know, it's sort of like it doesn't repeat itself. It's not like repetitive in the sense that it's always consistent, but it rhymes, right? And yeah, so I always talk about how like life rhymes. History doesn't necessarily repeat itself,
rhymes.
But it rhymes. And it's the same thing with these signals that we have for ourselves, right? Even if you're doing improv, right, there might be, you are also picking up on, you might be talking about something completely different, but you're getting this like feeling from the audience, like this is working. Let me go a little bit deeper here. Let me spend a little bit more time on this detail. Now, oh, you know what? This isn't working. Let me like pivot quickly to this other detail. And the context might change. The mix of people that you're with might change. And so I always talk about it like, if you have this equation, if you change even one variable, the entire equation needs to be sort of shifted. And that's what you're sort of seeing when you notice these things. But like it's not just the physical signals, it's also the emotional signals, right? Like I was saying, like if you're going to the trainer, what's changing is not just specific muscle groups. What's changing is also other muscle groups that are around there. It's also your mentality, it's also your positioning towards what you're eating, it's also your positioning towards other people that may or may not be working out. So all of these levers are pulling on each other as you're making these shifts. And that's why you change one variable, everything else is changing. And I think that the physical really does relate to the emotional, right, in many ways. So maybe I can take a couple of minutes now to talk a little bit about that emotional piece and how it connects to the physical. So, yeah, like it's not just that physical sensation you have. It's combined with the emotional sensations that you have, right? And what you're thinking, is it excitement? Is it fear? Is it what have you? And what makes gut feel sometimes hard also to study from a scientific perspective is that you do have lots of those folks who are saying, yeah, but isn't that just emotion? Isn't it just like a subconscious emotional reaction? And the way that I sort of think about it is like, you know, gut feel and emotions are a component of our intuiting process. They're a component of gut feel. But emotions are sort of like children, right? If you think about emotions like children, like you don't want them driving your car because they're going to crash it, right? But you also don't shove them in the trunk because they might die, right? You want them in the back seat where they can be seen and heard and attended to, but they're not actually completely in control of anything. Right. And that's the sort of same thing with emotions and gut feel. Right. You're not supposed to suppress your emotions. You're not shoving them in the trunk. Right. But you're also not letting them completely drive the car. You're giving them the right seat. They're a part of the process. They just shouldn't be steering. And this is where a lot of people often get mixed up. We tend to treat gut feel like it's a loud emotion, but it's not emotion. It's more layered. It's more nuanced. Right. It's your lived experiences, your subconscious pattern recognition, it's that physical, it's those physical sensations that you're feeling, it's your memory, and yes, it's like kind of rolled all into one executive summary. And, you know, what makes it tricky is that, you know, it sometimes does shout, but sometimes it is more quiet. And so one of the things I talk about, how do we tell this apart, right? How do we actually distinguish? How do we tell them apart? And, you know, what I tell people is, like, we do sort of let the emotions ride along, right? But one of the tricks I say is, like, well, ask yourself to, you can do two different things, right? The first is, like, asking yourself, am I acting from a place of clarity? Or am I acting from a feeling that I haven't yet named, right? Like, if I were completely calm, would I make the same decision, right? And if the answer is yes, it's probably your gut feel. But if the answer is no, right, it might be your emotions trying to take the front seat. So sometimes what you can do is, like, if you feel that there's, like, an urgency pushing you, right, or if you're getting this email and they're like, we want people part of Second City and there's this urgency, you can give it a little bit of time. And if it's your gut feel, that clarity will remain. And if it's the emotion, that sort of urgency will fade, just like sugar highs kind of fade. And that's how we can start to, like, let it be our compass in a little bit of ways, so that we can let our emotions come along for the ride and our physical sensations go along for the ride. We're just not giving them the keys.
So before we started the podcast, I told you this was a hard read for me. And I that's a compliment, by the way. And it was in the sense that this is complex. It's not, yes. It's not that the writing's obtuse. It's not that and I think I'm zeroing in on why. And I think that culturally speaking, the idea that you need to be both deeply curious and open to everything and also be confident to make quick decisions, we don't see those things living together.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great observation.
They're not soulmates.
Yeah, I love that observation. So, so a couple of things, right? Yes, this is, like, absolutely a hard read. And I love that you sort of said, you know, it's not a bad thing, right? I think that we should be placing ourselves in situations where we do read things that are hard. And we do, because it's worth it, right?
Yeah.
Gut feel is not easy to really master. We can master it, but, like, just like you, when you're winning the championship game, like, if it's easy, right, then everybody would do it and it wouldn't be this superpower, right? So it's absolutely this hard read. And what makes it so hard is because we're not just saying, oh, just trust it. Like, you know, you get this feeling, whatever. No, we're actually trying to disentangle it. We're trying to demystify it. We're trying to quantify it in a way that it's based on rigorous science. And that's part of what makes it really hard, along with the fact that when it's based on rigorous science, it's not linear. There is no five-step formula or five ingredient recipe on, like, how do you slot this together and make it work for yourself. And when you add to that your really interesting observation about we are told to be innovative, to be curious, to be, like, disruptive even in this way that that will reward itself because you're unique and you're different and you're innovative and all of these sort of things. But you couple this with the fact that doing that means that you're sort of shooting by the seat of your pants. You're always open to opportunity. You're always, like, being very improvisational and engaging in, like, bricolage, like MacGyver style kind of thing, right? That's very much at odds with taking action, with actually going off of trusting your gut feel and making sort of decisions. But it's such a
except in improvisation, because the audience is not going to put up with you just being quiet or playing around. They want to get to the joke.
And this is where that process piece is so important, where it's an intuitive process and a gut feel outcome. Because all along this process, you are still a part of this, just like you're a part of it during the improvisation. So what I talk about is, like, it's not that you're not taking action. It's just that you're taking lots and lots of actions. And this is a really critical point. Gut feel is what makes your gut feel so powerful is that you do take action, but you continue to iterate on that action, making it right. just like in improvisation, you have to act on something, but you're constantly bobbing and weaving and adding new things and subtracting new things and being able to sort of iterate along the way to make that process, to make that journey very worthwhile by the end. And so, you know, your audience leaves with like, that was incredible. I love how they were talking about Catherine Zeta-Jones. And from there, they're talking about, you know, alpha, beta, zeta, and like Greek letters. And from there, they went on to talk about, you know, like, you know, Roman alphabets. And then they went on to talk about Cicero and, you know, Julius Caesar. And, you know, it's like that journey, right? And so, you know, in the book, I also talk about like semantic distance, like distance between things. And that's like that same distance, right? The distance between Catherine Zeta-Jones to like Roman, you know, like we're looking at each iteration in between as well as like that entire journey. And so that's like part of the gut feel. Like, how did I get from, you know, tomatoes in the case of Dan Gusey, tomatoes to food for incarcerated individuals?
Yeah.
How did I get from here to there? Because of our gut feel, because of this intuiting process that led us to that.
I did a panel last week for Chirp Radio, which is an independent radio station here in Chicago. It's their 15th anniversary. And there was and the panels were sort of prominent Chicagoans, Jim DeRogatis, who sort of exposed Kanye and was a writer for the Sun-Times, music writer. Yeah. So he sort of was the moderator, and then there were chefs, Doug Sohn, who's known for hot dogs, the hot dog place, Tony Preckwinkle, who is the Cook County Board President, myself. And it was interesting because my dad was in radio, and I love radio. And I said, one of the experiences, what I understand a little bit from my reading is that, and it's a reason when I do my talks, I don't have a PowerPoint. Is because I recognize the power of the human voice.
Yeah.
And I said, there's a phrase that gets tossed around and to a number of people. I don't know who came up with it, but I love it, which is the shortest distance between two people is a laugh.
Mm, yeah.
And there's something in that, because the laugh is a aha recognition.
Yeah, it is.
That is 300 people at Second City at the same time all having it, which is why it's so amazing to go to those kinds of comedy shows, because that's just, it's rare that happens. That's usually something that's happening maybe with one other person. But the alchemy that led us there is everything you talk about in your book.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it really is, because we do this, we create the show over a 12-week process. We're iterating from the audience. And I love that you brought up subtracting, because I think of Lydie Klotz and the power of his book, because we never think to do that. And it's often where it's like you strip away, and that gets to the better laugh. That gets to
absolutely
laugh.
Right. There's research that shows that when we tell people improve, when we just tell them, how do you improve this, right? There's something around when we tell them, how do you improve this, that they think about adding new features, adding new things, adding. And we very rarely think about improving something by taking things away, right? We talked about this earlier, where there are things that we know, you already know, remove those things from your life, the habits, the people, right? We all have those friends that we've been friends with like forever. And we're like, I don't even know why I'm still friends with this person. It's just history. I don't even trust them with my dog, let alone like my children. Right. So there's all sorts of that aspect to it.
Okay. So for returning guests, we ask for a thank you because story. And this comes out of work we did at the University of Chicago, where you're trying to speak to people across difference. And what we found is if you use gratitude, if you really try to see and understand and value anything inside a person, that gives you a shot at sort of keeping going inside these difficult conversations. Do you have a thank you because story for us?
Yeah, I mean, I have so many thank you because stories, and I, you know, I write about so many of these. You know, a lot of the difficult situations that I typically have are usually because there's some sort of a preconceived, you know, either it's like, it can be anything from like a student who is like, wow, she's going to teach me about finance. Like, she's going to teach me about economics. Like, how can I be learning this really deeply quantitative thing from somebody who's doesn't look like, right? Or it can be like a client that I'm working with that's like in financial services, and you know, they all look a certain way and dress a certain way. And I can immediately tell that the content is going to not land how I think it's going to, you know, irregardless of what the content is, just based on who I am. And, you know, there's lots of those sort of difficult situations. So maybe I'll tell like more of a generality, like, because it's anytime anyone is facing something where they're like getting the door slammed in their face, or they don't look the right way or belong to the right networks or anything along those lines, the best, I think the way to navigate that is really this notion of delight, being able to delight them. And delight is something I talked about a little bit in my first book, but I also talk about in my second book, delighting your customers, delighting your suppliers, delighting your bosses, delighting your counterpart, anyone that you're sort of interacting with. Delight is not this, it's not necessarily positive or negative, right? It's this factor. I kind of like what you said, like the shortest distance between anyone is a laugh. I sort of think about that, yes and, right? Here's my yes and. It's laugh and it's also delight, because delight doesn't have to be about making someone laugh. It's about making them stop for a second.
Yeah.
And pausing and reconsidering things in a little bit of a different way. And that's what laughter can do. But that's also what, you know, this changing your perspective on something. So it's like being able, it's like stopping the music. You're out dancing somewhere and all of a sudden the music stops for a split second and then comes right back on. Or the lights go, you know, come on really quickly and then come back off. Everything's still the same, but it's dislodged something where you're now like, oh, wow, like I didn't, oh my gosh, now I'm feeling kind of awkward about the way I'm dancing. Or, oh, this person's here. I didn't know that they were here. Like it shifts something and changes something. And I think that when you're able to do that, that's when you're able to really like have that gut feel or have that intuition or really be able to steer things. And trust that you're seeing a new like level of abstraction.
This all makes me think. Early on in understanding that Second City has this corporate division that sells this work, I would get many people being like, "Oh, you're selling play," and I'm like, "Well, we are, but I am never going to say that because no one will buy play."
Right.
They'll buy improvisation. They see that, and improvisation started to be studied. But we are missing the boat by not studying play,
right?
Because this is exactly what happens in those situations where there's a game, it's delightful because it's just being played, where the rules are maybe obvious or we're making them up as we go along. And part of that play is discovering what those rules are. And, you know, it's just like, and also we don't study comedy in that same way. And when you think about so much of laughter is coming from surprise.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought A was going to equal B, which was going to equal C, but then D came along and it was like, oh, you meant a different thing. And so that those are all those things we're talking about. And yet they're considered, you know, silly sometimes to study. And I think we're missing something there.
Yeah. Agreed.
The book is called You Already Know: The Science of Mastering Your Intuition. Laura Huang, so great to have you on the podcast again.
Thank you. You too. Great chatting with you.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Screaming atop of their lungs. survives.
Adulthood, no one survives.